Hello and welcome to I'm the Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, it's welcome return to friend of the podcast, Matt Everett. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm excited.
It's another big one, isn't it? They're all big and important in their own ways, these re-releases, but this is, I know a lot of people have been waiting a long time for this.
And hopefully, if I can edit everything, it's going to be released on the same day as the box set. It's the Revolver Super Deluxe Edition.
Good luck with the edit. I'll try and be as concise as possible and not say things again.
Thank you.
Again.
So, the Revolver Super Deluxe Edition. You can get it on CD, or I think a lot of people are going for the vinyl. You get four LPs and a 7-inch vinyl EP. Released today on the 28th of October 2022. And the box set features a new mix by Giles Martin and Sam O'Kell, the original mono mix, a four-track EP, a 100-page book with a foreword by Paul McCartney and extracts from Klaus Voormann's graphic novel. But more importantly, there's a double album of 31 session takes and home demos. Plus, it uses Robert Freeman's proposed front cover collage. How exciting.
It is. It's brilliant, isn't it? I was fortunate enough to go to Abbey Road when they sort of debuted a few of the tracks for selected media bellends like myself. And the people that are fortunate enough to get asked to do these things. Yeah. And Giles Martin did a little presentation and played some of the stuff. And it was just, it sounds great. It sounds phenomenal. The demixing process that they've done on it, which has been talked about a lot, was set up by Peter Jackson to work on the Get Back doc, is kind of in full effect here. I love the fact, I was thinking about this. Apparently, I think Giles said this, so Peter Jackson developed this technology that can extrapolate out individual instruments and voices from just one track or unmixed stuff, so you can hear, as we know in the documentary, different voices, but on this album, different instruments as well. Apparently, Peter Jackson won't let anyone else use it. Apparently, it's just like, it's, yeah, really? I've developed it, it's for the Beatles. It's like, wow. Oh, yeah, what's it? So I don't think, it's not like Pink Floyd are going to be like, oh, it'd be really great to get access to this new technology. No, can't have it.
Yeah.
Isn't that brilliant?
Oh, it's amazing. Brilliant. So let's have a quick bit of background. What was going on at the time? So the Beatles were contractually obligated to make their third feature film. And at this point, they were planning to do Richard Condon's A Talent for Loving, which would have seen them in a cowboy movie set in the 19th century.
Oh,
yeah. Apparently, in the Beatles Monthly, there was lots of this. There was sort of, oh, what's going to happen? They were scheduled to film at the beginning of 1966 in Mexico or Spain. But this was shelved apparently after they read the script. So, and they, basically what it meant that for the first time since Making It Big, they had 4 months in which nothing was booked. So before recording Revolver, they'd had a really long break. George had married Patty Boyd. But on the 6th of April 1966, they returned to EMI and started recording Mark 1 on the 6th of April, which we also know as Tomorrow Never Knows.
Well, I mean, that's not a bad way of starting a session, is it? It's not bad going.
It's all right.
It's all right. I was, like a lot of people, and we have talked about this before, brought up on the Red and Blue albums, those two records, those two compilations. And Revolver is so criminally underserved on those albums. It's always had a very special place in my heart because of that. It's the art school one. It's the strange one, isn't it? This was always the one that when I discovered it felt like the sort of secret record. And I know lots of people feel that way about it. It's the first really strange one. And I was looking again at the cover before I did this. And I was thinking about the sunglasses on the back cover. They're all wearing sunglasses. And I went down a bit of a rabbit hole about how, what that represents in terms of how they were feeling about the world and how they were feeling about the way they were perceived and wanted people to perceive them. Because the Beatles had worn sunglasses before, yes, primarily when it was sunny, when they were doing something outdoors, because that's what sunglasses are for. In this photo, they're wearing them indoors, which is normally a dick manoeuvre, is it not, wearing sunglasses indoors? But this is like they're wearing them as a kind of we're going to perceive things differently. We're going to look differently at the world through these lenses. Yeah. And the picture on the back is no one's looking at the camera. It doesn't feel posed at all. It feels like someone just came in, shot a photo of them when they were chatting to each other. It's not even the most flattering picture. John's got really terrible posture. He's like, he's hunched over. His shoulders are up by his neck. And he looks like, it's not the best shot. But it represents, we're not really concerned anymore with how you're seeing us.
Yes.
We don't really mind anymore. It's about what we want to do. And hence, like, this idea of, they didn't wear a lot of sunglasses occasionally. This is the sort of point they started to wear sunglasses indoors. I'm getting a bit hooked up on this, but it's like, it's a very conscious thing to look at the world differently when you don't have to indoors. And I think it's like everything becomes rose-tinted or blue-tinted or whatever. And I just thought, even though Ringo's are a little bit, the little overglasses are a bit odd, it says a lot about them. It's not just about being cool. Yeah, I just wondered at what point wearing sunglasses indoors became a thing and whether they're pioneers of that as well, I don't know.
Why not? Give them everything, I say. Tomorrow never knows. You've got John through the Leslie speaker. The thing about this, I mean, this was the 6th of April, Mark 1, take 1. Mm-hmm. And it was only a few months, the last thing they recorded was Girl. And what a leap. You know?
To this day, it still sounds radical. This early version, a version of which appears on the anthology, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I think Paul describes it as John sort of earnestly strumming through this song. But it is... It's radical not just in terms of how it sounds or in terms of the fact that there's a loop, which is something that Paul had said he'd been sort of experimenting with, little sound loops at home. But there's a real leap from going, okay, we're going to mess about with song structures to going, no, there's just no structure at all now. We're just going to have the same thing going around like that. And this idea of repetition, this idea of the power of doing the same thing again and again and again. That's quite a leap to like go, oh, there's no verse, there's no chorus, there's no intro, there's no bridge, there's no hook or melody in the music other than just this cyclical thing. It's pretty staggering, isn't it? Still to this day, you know?
And the sound of the drums.
Yeah. I mean, look, this is a very good Ringo record, isn't it? He really does. This is some of the best Ringo that you're going to get. I think... This idea that it's a psychedelic album anyway, I find it's quite odd. This is supposed to be the Beatles' big psychedelic record. But it's so much more than that. It's so much harder, even though the first track that we're going to focus on is Tomorrow Never Knows. It's not a conventional psychedelic record in terms of like cosmic colours and skipping through the fields. It's not groovy in that way. It's a lot more charged than that. There's like, you know, there's kitchen sink dramas and Eastern mysticism and like... an advert for a drug dealer on it. It's a lot more complex and multifaceted than just, oh, it's their big psychedelic record. It's not. It's more than that. Although it does start with this song. And I don't know. Lennon preaching, isn't it? He's quite a sinister figure on this song. This is not like, hey, peace and love. Everything's groovy. Yeah. Love is the word. This is like, he's telling you what to do. He is imparting wisdom from this... place of all knowing, even though it was only like 26 or something. It's a lot darker than the day glow kind of psychedelia that it inspired in many ways, don't you think?
Yeah, a lot of his songs depend on what he was reading at the time, I think. So obviously he's reading Timothy Leary at this time, and then you think around A Day in the Life, and that he's reading the Daily Mail. So it's more like a suburban. I'm sure it was you who mentioned the use of the words like cornflakes in all these psychedelic songs. So you get that sort of suburban everyday life, but with that lysergic shimmer around it.
This is definitely John on the top of a mountain, sort of trying to contact the dead, isn't it, really? It's a lot more scary than that. And it's still, you know, like... I was having this conversation about Stuart Sutcliffe with some friends the other day, and we were talking about this idea of how his influence on them, not in terms of just the kind of look of being a character and a wonderful person and, you know, really interesting guy. His, this idea of questing, that's a terrible word, but this idea of kind of looking for deeper meaning in everything and looking for how far you could go in line. I live in Liverpool, I'm going to go and live in Hamburg. I've met these amazing people. And that, I think, Mike Lewisham talks about him being a really significant Beatle, because he's sort of set those wheels in motion, those cogs in motion of, like, it doesn't have to be normal. You can do something totally different. Your reference points for what you liked 6 months ago, they don't have to be the same anymore. I'm going to look like this. I'm going to hang out with these people. I'm going to travel here. I'm going to do these paintings. And you can, that's this is, Tomorrow Never Knows is kind of part of the logical extension of thinking like that, isn't it? Like, we don't have to have a song, you know, it's one chord. It doesn't modulate. It just, this version especially, it just travels along like endlessly. It doesn't ever stop. It is this loop that just travels round and round and round and round and still sounds, yeah, still sounds incredibly radical, doesn't it?
I remember first hearing this when the anthologies came out, and it just blew my head. I do love speaking to people who discovered the Beatles in the 90s via the anthologies. So they've got the double thing of hearing this. And then, I mean, track two on here, we've got a mono mix. Basically, it was RM11. It originally went on early pressings of Revolver.
Yeah.
But it's basically the same version, but with slightly different mix and different loops. But then they would have heard that.
Yeah. I remember, just as a sidebar, there's a Chemical Brothers Noel Gallagher song called Setting Sun. You know that tune? Yeah. Which is the Chemical Brothers kind of doing this. And apparently the working title for that was Tomorrow Never Knowles.
Was it?
Which they should have stuck with that.
Yes.
They should have stuck with Tomorrow Never Knowles. But yeah, it's kind of become a shorthand for how far out you can go, isn't it? Like, it's used really brilliantly in that episode of Mad Men to kind of illustrate how out of touch Don Draper is with the revolution. But it's far stranger and more sinister and more experimental than that. And it is still a deeply, deeply odd record.
I was alone, I took a ride, I didn't know what I would find there. Another road where maybe I could see another kind of mind there.
We've got another one that we've heard before on Anthology. It's Got to Get You Into My Life, the first version, which is take 5. And in the studio, you've got John talking about fading in the organ. And the banter on this is very much recalling Twickenham in Get Back, just hearing them chatting away in the studio.
Yeah, I was really interested about the fade in, because I was like, oh, like, you have fade outs in songs, why not have a fade in? And everyone's like, oh, it was the first fade in was
8 days a week.
Yeah, 8 days a week. But it was the, I think the Supremes did a fade in like before then, but it was still a relatively new thing. Like, let's just have a song fading in rather than starting from the blue. And Paul's vocal on this is just, it's completely bolted down already, isn't it? It's absolutely, it's not the final version, but it could quite easily be. And this is such an early take, and he knows exactly how he's going to phrase it. He knows exactly, not that there's a freedom to it, but all the information, all the ideas that will go up to result in the final take, you can hear them. Ringo's snare sounds amazing as well. It's like walloping away at it. And there's a version after this that's got a weird little fuzz noise in it. And I was like, what's that? And I thought it was a styrofoam initially. It's not, because that wasn't going to be invented for like another couple of years. So it was in advance of technology as they were, they hadn't had something that wasn't invented on a record. But it's this weird little fuzz tone effect that George uses, and that's what kind of ends up being the horn section.
I was alone, I took a ride, I didn't know what I would find there. Another road where maybe I could see another kind of mind.
So you can see them working through ideas in every single recording, which is just glorious.
On the first version, you've got that.
I need your love, I need your love, I need your love, I need your love.
so beautiful. But I think the one that you're talking about, which for me is like the highlight of this whole box, and I think along with Across the Universe on Anthology, possibly a contender for a Beatles outtake that's superior to the original officially released version.
Controversial, but Chris.
This is so beautiful. It's literally the middle version. You've got the first version with all the harmonies. This one's got all the guitars and the harmonies and the highlight. And then you've got the ooh in harmonies. Ooh. It's just perfect. And the guitars are effectively doing what the brass would do.
Yeah. I know it was sort of supposed to be a sort of a Stax sort of Motown-y song. It doesn't sound like a Stax Motown-y song, really. Although other people have cut, there's an Ella Fitzgerald version that's pretty banging, isn't there? But yeah, I was reading in the notes to the box set, which are beautiful and glorious in all their detail. And I didn't know that they'd wanted to go and work at Stax Studios. They'd wanted to record in Memphis with like Steve Cropper and all those musicians. And it didn't happen. And I think the quote is, I think Paul said, things kept getting in the way, like money. It's like, A, you're the Beatles. Surely if you say you want to go and record, you know, with Booker T and the MGs, then like surely make that. But can you, what would the Beatles in Memphis sound like? What kind of record would that have been?
It almost needs another album. It'd be nice to have another album in 1966, say in autumn, where they'd release all that stuff. And don't.
I know. Yeah. I mean, as much as obviously, like, you know, like any time they don't record an Abbey Road, I feel like it's like a partner who's being cheated on. It's like, you can't do that. No.
Yeah.
Back to Studio 2. Stop it. Casting your eye around other places. Okay, you can flirt with Trident, but you're coming back. You're coming back to Abbey. I do feel, which is ridiculous, but I do feel a bit like that. And it's about getting stoned, which is a pretty direct song.
I wonder if that was the reason that they didn't go.
Maybe that was it.
Oh, can't be bothered.
Got me arsed. Yeah, but like, got to get you into my life. I've got to get stoned. Pretty straight ahead, bless them.
There's one more version where you get the horn section. And it's interesting here, you've still got all those guitar riffs all the way through. And on the final version that was officially released, it only happens once, right at the end. On that... And it's so more powerful for it, rather than having it all the way through.
Yeah, I thought about... Yeah, because on this, there's the version with the horns and that you're talking about. It's really, really punchy, really sort of, you know, aggressive horns right in the mix. It sounds brilliant. And the guitars are way back in the mix. They're so in the background. They're just barely textural. And it's like, that shows... That's a lack of ego, isn't it? It's like, yeah, okay, this is... Yeah. I am one of the Beatles, and my guitar part is so important. Actually, it's not as important as the horns. We can just... Doesn't matter. That lack of ego, I think, is pretty impressive as well. It's about the song now.
Each day just goes so fast, I turn around, it's past. You don't get time to hang a sign on me.
So then we get Love You Too. We've got Take One, which was called Granny Smith at this point. George couldn't think of any title. An Unnumbered Rehearsal and Take Seven.
I really love George's little amazing demo because... It's just obviously wonderful just to hear his voice. But you do, without the beautiful Indian instruments, the kind of sitar and the tambora and the tabla and everything, some of the sort of mysticism, because he obviously knows how it's going to sound, but obviously the kind of the cosmicness of it hasn't really appeared yet. So, and some of the lyrics do feel a little bit like, what is it? Make love while you can before I'm a dead old man.
Yeah.
It's quite on the nose that, I mean, we better do it now. Gonna be dead soon. Quick.
And singing songs as well.
Well, yeah, make love singing songs. No. What no. song? What? That's...
The Minute Waltz.
Is that a good idea for anyone to be singing? Okay, darling, I'm ready. Shall we harmonise? No, I'm going to do Maxwell Silver Hammer. And then...
Bang,
and also make love all day long. I mean, that's frankly exhausting. That's not going to happen. Yeah. I mean, it's optimistic. But then, yeah, I'll make love to you if you want me to.
If you want me to.
George. Yes. Thanks. I'm just checking. I presume, because we've been... I mean, yes, I'm saying get there sharpish before I'm a dead old man. So that's, you know, but also at the same time, if you want me to, I'm just checking. Is that all right?
I think it's exactly that in the context of him just strumming his guitar. Because his guitar sounds a bit like, if you've heard the Mean Mr. Mustard demo from the Isha demo.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah. It's very like that. So it's almost like a jaunty little...
you see, we're stripping apart like such a beautiful song. But yeah, but then you get this staggering instrumentation that comes on it. And what becomes really apparent when you hear some of these versions is his total commitment to it. Like, and obviously people had used, well, they'd used Norwegian wood, a little bit of sitar, and other people had used, bands of the eye had used little bits of Indian instrumentation. But he was like, no, the whole song, the whole thing. Absolutely, this is not a song that's got any European pop foundation at all. In the instrumentation, at least. And I thought that was, you know, everyone going, oh, yeah, we put a bit of, you know, sitar on this track, on the solo. It's like, no, we're doing the whole thing. We're going to do the whole arrangement. Yeah. It's going to be based around Indian instrumentation, which is a hugely, brilliantly brave thing to do.
With things like Paint It Black and, well, there was loads of them, wasn't there? But
yeah,
they tended to use the same way that he did in Norwegian Wood.
Exactly.
But you hear him on that rehearsal where he's just going through... He sounds amazing. He's clearly put in the hours for this. You know how focused he is when he's learning something. You can see it and get back. He's got to get it right. It's taken over him.
Yeah, absolutely. Although, as we talked about, I mean, it was... Didn't he pick up a sitar on the set of Help? Isn't that how he found it? As we've talked about before, that could have been a balalaika. That could have been a lute. Could have been a banjo. You know, the whole... It could have been a very different scenario. But, I mean, it is... like, Indian music is some of the oldest forms of music in human history, and the structures are completely different. The scales are different, and the tuning's different. So to really immerse yourself in something that's so unfamiliar is just phenomenally brave and just glorious. And everybody else was kind of skirting around these things, and he was just wholeheartedly, completely committed to it. I love it.
From the 13th of April 1966, in an evening session that went on from 8 p.m. till 2:30 in the morning, it's Paperback Writer, takes 1 and 2.
Oh, crikey. I know the playback thing I went to, they played a little bit of Yellow Submarine and a little bit of Taxman and some stuff, and you could see everyone like, yeah, but Rain and Paperback Writer's on there as well. You've got some, because they are... They represent such an important part. They're the kind of two figureheads of where they were at this point in their life. This demo might be the greatest guitar sound ever committed to tape. It's absolutely phenomenal. And you've got that thing where you can just hear them. It's still there, that thing where they just play together. When they just... experimentation aside... And, you know, questing, whatever you want to call it, this idea of momentum and movement and evolving and doing new things and being fearless. It's also, but also when we just play together in a room, we sound amazing. And that's what this is, the groove that they kind of create. And Ringo, oh, there's a lot of Ringo's finest moments. They're all Ringo's finest moments. All of Ringo's moments are his finest moments. I'm very glad he's recovering well from COVID. To this day, it sounds phenomenal. I don't know, how do they do that bass thing? I've read lots about how Paul McCartney's bass sound on Rain and Paperback Writer got so phenomenally huge and warm, but I don't really understand how they did it. I don't, something to do with taking a speaker and turning it to a microphone. I don't care. It sounds fucking great. And there's that quote in the beautiful book as well. When asked like the lyrical inspiration for Paperback Writer, Paul said he had a conversation with his auntie Aunt Millie. My auntie said to me, why do you always write songs about love all the time? Can't you write a song about a horse or the summit conference or something interesting? So it was like, you're writing a bit too much about love.
Yeah.
Go and write about something else. All right, fine, okay, I will.
Yeah.
It's great.
Because we've got the basic track here, and this is the 13th of April, but we do have lots of information for the following day when they recorded the vocals. And again, if you've seen Get Back, this will probably ring a few bells. So I'm just going to read a bit from here. This is from the June 1966 edition of the Beatles book. John and Paul were working out a detailed backing. Paul was perched on a stool, thumbing away at a red and white Rickenbacker, moving with the music just as he does on stage, whilst the lyrics boomed through the studio speakers. So we're very honoured at being the first to hear the new Beatles single, besides George Martin and, of course, the Beatles. We then spotted Ringo's head behind the screen in the far corner. He was playing chess with Neil. So we walked over. Who's winning? I asked. Neil's the expert, Ringo replied, and went back to the chessboard to concentrate on how to get his king out of danger from an attack by Neil's bishop and castle. The music stopped. The studio was littered with pianos, grand pianos, and other odd bits and pieces which were strewn over the studio floor. The big, heavy, soundproof door, which stops any of the world seeping the studio, burst open, and in strolled George Martin looking very elegant in his Mongolian lamb fur coat with black cap and oblong metal specs. He was obviously on top of the world and bubbling over with enthusiasm, ready to record a dozen numbers. He threw his coat alongside Paul's fur jacket and got down to work out the backing with John and Paul. John, George and George Martin huddled round Paul, who was seated at the piano trying to work out a bass bit, before asking George Martin to play it. John leaned on the piano while he listened to Paul's ideas for a while. Then he picked up his orange Gretsch guitar and proceeded to pick away at it. At the same time, Paul transferred to a Vox organ. Although John and Paul were working on the song together, it was originally Paul's idea. He asked the engineer to play it back at half speed so that John and George could do the vocal bits. Now they were all set to go. George Martin gave the okay, the recording light went on, and the basic soundtrack was played back through the cans, in inverted commas, they each clamped over their heads. They did several takes. John and George hit some very high notes, but their voices kept cracking. I don't think I can make it, said George, unless I have a cup of tea. Where's Mal? Right on cue at the end of the fourth take, Mal emerged into the studio laden with tea, biscuits and something very special. Toast and strawberry jam. Everything was immediately dropped, and a sudden swoop was made on the toast and jam. Ringo, who was still in the corner trying to work out his next move, only got one piece of toast. So Mal offered to make another batch, as it proved so popular. After the toast and jam had been devoured, it was back to work. Paul suddenly got an inspiration. He dived across to the piano and started playing a bit of Frère Jacques. He was delighted at the thought of having it on the new single. Okay, let's try it, said George Martin. So John and George gathered round the mic and off they went, but it was a false start. After they had finished taping these bits, the tracks were played back into the studio while everyone listened in silence. George Martin was the first to speak. I think that the best bit we've added were the Frère Jacques bits. Ringo, who had finally beaten Neil at a game of chess by checkmating him in several brilliant moves involving a queen, a bishop and a castle, said that he thought John and Paul sounded as though they were singing through water. Highly uncomplimentary. So Paul then made for the organ once again and started to work out a sound which resembled that of Scottish bagpipes. John then came swooping across the studio and shouted out, "You've got it! You've got it!" Paul then started dum-de-dum-ding away at everybody else. It was like a scene from My Fair Lady. George Martin appeared over John's shoulder and said, "I see what you mean." Paul announced that someone else should play it, meaning George Martin. John and George then went back to their mics and added the vocals over the top. After the first track, Paul looked over the top of the piano and asked John and George if they were singing it right. George turned round, lowered his glasses to the tip of his nose, and looked down at Paul in a typically schoolmasterly fashion and said, "To the best of our ability, Paul." And so the boys went on getting the sound that you will hear on Paperback Writer.
Oh, I mean, there's a lot there to unpick, isn't there? I mean, first of all, they could have eaten anything. They could have had like chocolate coated ants' brains and lobsters in Prussian blue waistcoats delivered to their door on silver platters.
By Mal.
No. By Mal, if they wanted, but no. Oh, toast and jam. What's that? It just paints such a lovely picture. We are, you know, we're sort of on the very, very outer rim of musical creativity and experimentation in 1966, and we're powered by toast and jam and cups of tea. And obviously the occasional bifter, I'm more than sure. But yeah. Gar Mal.
It does give you some insight into the Twickenham sessions though, Apple as well, in Get Back. And Mal is very much, his place is very much set in stone. Yeah. And there's a little niggle between George and Paul as well.
Yeah. I just want a Mal. I want a Mal in my life. I want a big, like huge, like 6'5", whatever, really friendly, lovely, warm, accommodating man just to kind of help me with my life generally. To kind of like, Mal, where's my phone? It's all right. It's over here. Oh, thanks, Mal. Yeah. Mal, what's can you pick the kids up? Yeah, don't worry, I'll do it. I think everybody would love a Mal.
He'd be very warm in the winter as well.
Yeah, you could cuddle him.
Yeah.
He'd be like, he'd get stuff done, wouldn't he? You're like, oh, that guttering. It's all right, I've done it. Oh, yeah. Thanks, Mal. Like, I haven't had time to make breakfast. Here you are. Here's some toast and jam. Thanks, Mal. Yeah. I'd put him in a spare room, like in the house. I'd have a Mal, of course.
We all need a Mal.
We all need a Mal in our lives.
There's a lovely bit in the book where you see the original lyrics of Paperback Writer. He actually writes it like a letter, and it signs off, "Yours sincerely, Ian Iachimo." I don't know if you know about Ian Iachimo.
No, who's Ian Iachimo?
If you record the name Paul McCartney and play it backwards, that apparently is Ian Iachimo. And this was the pseudonym Paul used because they've got so much fan mail. And if anybody wanted to write to him, he said, use that name and then I'll know that it's, you know, I'll know who you are.
Nice.
So that's how he had his correspondence. But he used to contribute to the Indica Gallery as well using that name. Nice. And there's a, sorry to read more stuff out, but there's something.
No, please, please.
The Long Hair Times, which is like a forerunner for the International Times. And I have to point out, this was published on April the 1st, but it reads, Ian Iachimo, the Polish New Wave film director, is offering a prize of 20 guineas to anyone who can supply the missing link in the following script. The dialogue is not needed, just the idea. Here is the outline of the story. A woman, aged 35 to 45, is fanatical about cleanliness. She's amazingly house proud and obsessional about getting rid of dirt. This carries over in her dress, looks, and so on. Something happens to make her have to crawl through a great load of dirt, old dustbins, and so on. Good old honest dirt. What is this something? What is needed is the idea. What could cause her to have become involved with filth? She is not forced to do it, but chooses to do it herself. Send all answers, as many as you like, to Ian Iachimo, care of Indica Books Gallery.
Oh, Paul was just having a whale of a time, wasn't he? He was just absolutely throwing himself wholeheartedly into everything that the counterculture, the thing that he helped create, is now feeding back into his experiences and just loving it. It's funny that, because there is, on this whole record, there's a lot of humour. It's Rubber Soul, which is one of my favourite records, isn't, you know, I'm not saying it's a po-faced record, but it hasn't got as much frivolity, maybe that's not the right word, as this album. Dr. Robert's pretty funny. Yellow Submarine, I always used to think it was funny. Now, as we'll come on to in a minute, it's heartbreaking. They're having a laugh a lot of the time, but also, I mean, and this song, it's like, it's quite a comedic premise, isn't it? But it's still got such artistic weight to it at the same time. It's so valid. They're so good, they can fanny about. It was the only one from the record they played live on their 66 tour, wasn't it? And like, couldn't quite get it right. Even though you look at the footage and it's still pretty fucking amazing, the vocals. Yeah, it's...
Well, the thing that amazes me about that is that because they didn't really rehearse, all of the older stuff, rock and roll music, they don't need to rehearse it. They've played it a million times. The only time they played this is what we're listening to on this, you know, two recordings.
Yeah.
So they probably had a quick run through before.
But it'll be fine.
This is it. This is the rehearsal. Two versions of Rain, starting with the actual speed version.
The WTF version. Like, you're like, what? Because you, if you're like, you know, a little bit obsessed with this stuff, like lots of us are, you know that it was recorded and then slowed down. But I've never heard this version at the proper speed. And your brain goes, that's wrong. No, it's completely wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
It's no, stop it. It's not right. It's not. And then after you listen to it a few times, you kind of get in it. And then you just, you're amazed at the precision of the playing. This is for me. So if you slow something down, any mistakes are drawn out, are longer or bigger anymore, anything else that's out of time. That amount of scrutiny will show up any mistakes in the playing, anything that doesn't feel right in the groove or the tempo or anything. And it stands up. It's yes. Like, it's, they've taken this incredible performance and it withstands being stretched, you know, like a piece of rubber. I mean, the bass playing and the drumming is phenomenal anyway, on if it was done at the speed that you know it. And on this version, you hear Paul and Ringo just like, what the actual hell? How are they doing that at that speed? Yeah. And Ringo's drumming is, you know, without going on and on and on about the unpredictability of his fills, the musicality of how he plays, there's... I don't know how he does those things. I don't know. And he said, like, he never did the same thing twice, which is totally great as well. Mm. But it is such a capturing of such an amazing performance. It's that perfect performance. And the fills come in at really weird moments and do strange things.
They do.
Yeah. Or it's all over the shop. But it's perfect. It works. It just works. I mean, there's... I've said this before... No one else can play like him, but I don't think anybody else could even do a passable version of this. And you know, there's people on YouTube that go, oh, I'm going to do this Ringo part. And and sometimes, like, okay, you've done the Abbey Road drum solo. That's not bad. That sounds, there's some of, obviously technically, in terms of what they're playing, it's spot on because they've studied it. But the feel, went to go and see the... Analogues at the Palladium.
Brilliant.
A few weeks ago, which was really good, and the drummer's great, and he did like the drum solo at the end of Abbey Road. And you're like, that's pretty good, but nobody can get this one right. No one can get anything, even if they're playing all the right notes in the right order on the drums. There's no one that can recreate the feel. It's absolutely impossible. It exists. It's a masterpiece of Ringo's drumming because it is so integral to the song, and it's just the most incredibly well-rounded performance. When he is busy, it's at the right moment. When he sits back, it's at the right moment. It's a capturing of an absolute masterstroke of playing. It's so good. And to hear it at that speed blows my tiny effing mind.
Didn't Elvis Stardust say that? Is that him? On those road safety adverts.
Oh,
you
yeah.
must be out of your tiny effing mind.
Oh, the late 70s and early 80s safety films. Go That's near that pylon and you'll die.
But it is, yeah. They're so tight together, they hook in together, and the bass is kind of doing the same thing as well.
Yeah. Amazing. And then, as I say, to put it under the scrutiny of slowing it down, and it's still totally works.
We've got the slowed down version from the master tape, minus John's backward vocals, and you've got a full ending as well. And they did the right thing by slowing it down. It just, you know, changed everything, made it so eerie.
Yeah. God, they were good. Well, feeling fine.
Then we got take 7 of Dr. Roberts with an extra well, well, well. And a clean ending.
And a clean ending. What's this song? Drugs are great. What was that? Yeah, drugs are great. That's basically what we're saying. They're brilliant. They're really good. I mean, and like, see, it's coming back to my thing about it's not just a psychedelic record. It's far more complex than that. The kind of the bravery and naivety of writing a song like this about, just brilliant. Drugs will solve everything. They'll be absolutely wonderful. You'll have a great time. Everyone's going to be fine. In no way is this colossal ingestion of hallucinogenics going to backfire to anyone at any point. It's great. And we think that, so we're going to write a song about it and put it on the record of the biggest band in the world, and we're happy to stand behind it. That's, as I say, incredibly brave and colossally naive at the same time. But this idea of just so wholeheartedly throwing yourself into... That's the fearless thing, is it? Like throwing yourself off the cliff. This will be brilliant!
Yeah. Well, again, Timothy Leary, you know, he was basically saying the same thing. Putting LSD in the water, wasn't it? And all that sort of thing. So they're kind of extolling those. But, as a song, it's fun.
Exactly. Drugs, exactly. It's, you know, and obviously you can... This is, you've just helped me refine my point about the humour that I was saying. It's kind of an amusing song about something that is clearly has got really far-reaching consequences that could be enormously dangerous and damaging to people. And they're kind of making a joke about it because I guess they don't really know yet. I don't know. Drugs are bad, kids.
Yeah, just say no.
Just say no.
Don't do it, don't do it. All you got to do is be yourself.
Yeah, man.
As Gripper Simpson once said.
Pass the crack pipe.
The next three tracks, the first two are pretty well the same. It's And Your Bird Can Sing. We've got the first version, take two, and then the first version, take two, with the giggling that you might have heard on Anthology.
Yeah, I like, you were talking about bits they do and then they end up in the final version and how pretty much, you know, their taste is impeccable. The things that aren't supposed to be there aren't there. But the version, this version that's got the little fill, the get me, and there's a drum and a bass kind of lock-in fill, that should have been in the final one. I think I'm not telling them what to do, quite clearly. They don't need me doing that. But of all the judgment calls, or the calls, creative calls they make, I like that bit so much. It brings me so much joy. It's glorious. Once again, Ringo and Paul playing out of their skins. You don't get me. And the giggling is just, even when they're giggling, they do hit a harmony. They do still manage to hit the harmonies, don't they?
Yes.
Like that hardwired ability to harmonize with each other and make it sound so beautiful and so easy, even when they're stoned out of their gourd and having a laughing fit. And they're giggling. It's a proper giggling fit as well. It's not just belly laughs. It's proper silly little giggles. It's just, it's joy again, isn't it? It's just absolute joy. It says so much about them and about the freedom that they had and how much they just reveled in it, that they didn't stop. I'm not sure if that was comped from a couple of versions, but they kept going. And obviously, George was like, keep on recording. This is great. Because something might have come out of it, or it was just a lovely thing to have, or, you know, being a producer is one about sound, but it's about capturing a moment. You know, it's what's created when people perform together. And George Martin captured a really lovely moment there that says so much about them as people and how much they love playing and singing and getting battered, clearly.
When your boink is broken, it's my favourite bit. You tell me that you've got everything you want, and your bird can sing, but you don't get me.
You don't get me. Then you get this second version, which is this is one of the big surprises on the box set for me, was this other version that's really, really slow. It's kind of a stomping, almost swampy kind of thing. Yeah, it's a lovely illustration that try things differently. There's no reason it has to be. You can go down different alleyways, you know, and great producers, you know, often say, oh, it can be any way you want it to be. Try it slow, try it fast. And this is them trying it slow. And obviously, it's a different, completely different feeling song. But I quite like it as well. It's good, isn't it?
It's very heavy. And John sounds regal on this. There's when they're going, when your prized possessions, they do the four snare.
Dun,
it's a Motown kind of thing. And then you've got those beautiful eyes. Like on a, If I Needed Someone, they do like a bar of just R in. It's beautiful.
Yeah. I love the fact that exists, and you can be so surprised by a song that you've known for so many years and hear a version of it that completely changes everything about the song. Even though the chords are the same, it's just a completely different experience listening to it. It's great. Yeah. Good work.
I think also it's because Paul's playing, he doesn't go up on the chord changes, he stays on one note on the bass, so it gives it a slightly ethereal feel as well. Yeah, it's amazing track.
1, 2, 3, 4 1, 2
Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me.
Then we've got Take 11 of Taxman, which we've obviously heard on Anthology 2.
When I was younger, I used to think, oh, it's a little bit of a, not mean spirit, but it's George having a pop about money. But it's actually such a subversive thing to do, to write a song about this when you're who you are at that point in music history. It's really, and now I think about it in completely different terms. I don't think about it as being like, oh, you know, it's a bit rubbish. We're not getting it's far more subversive than that. That's its kind of power. And maybe this is me being a bit late to the game. But it's like if Taylor Swift wrote a song now about the IRS, right?
Yeah.
Or Ed Sheeran wrote a song about HMRC. That would not happen. Those people in that artistic realm are not supposed to and never do comment on the mundane and frustrating difficulties of financial institutions in the world. You don't do that. It's not supposed to be your place. You can talk about politics, you can talk about anything in a song, but bureaucracy is very rarely used as a subject matter for songs. I mean, I guess Pink Floyd did it a little bit, but it was always with a view to the bureaucracy of life is a reflection of our own, like, you know, our limited time as humans and all that stuff. Whereas this is just about, oh, this stuff's just shit, isn't it? This sucks. And he's not doing it from a position of although he was an enormously successful rock star, he's doing it the position of someone who literally with his mates pulled themselves out of the streets by dint of their own talent and hard work and are now being screwed by it, which we can all, whatever point it is, it's like, why? This is rubbish. This is not how things should work. Yeah, no one writes songs about bureaucracy except like Taxman. It's such a fantastic, it's a really subversive thing to write a song about at this or any time, as I say.
And this is a year after they'd had the MBE.
Yes, exactly.
So now that, you know, the Daily Mail will be thinking, oh, well, they've got a bit of respectability now. Nah, I'll listen to this.
Yeah, do you think there was like, he had one eye on, well, maybe they'll change my tax band if I moan about it enough, maybe they'll like, you know.
I think he did like a whinge, didn't he?
This is true. Yeah, this is also true. But it's the cornflakes thing again, isn't it? Writing about the minutiae of actual life, even when you're in the Beatles.
Obviously, the bit about this, you've got that, anybody get up an MLE, anybody get up? Which is, I'm glad they dropped.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't good to see them do it. Yeah, if Radiohead wrote a song about, like, mortgage rises, you know, it's not going to happen. Sorry, just going back to that thought. It stuck with my head. Be good, though. 3.6%. Yeah, it's protest, isn't it? It's protest music. It's running against the authorities again.
I've got a theory.
Hit me.
Right, this is something I've wanted to talk about for ages, actually. It's just an excuse, but Dan Rebellato, who's been on before, alerted me to this. Is George's dragging melodic rhythms. And if you listen, I think you can find them in pretty well every song he's ever released. People will disprove this, but anyway, so on this, so it's just that dragging behind the beat. So let me tell you how it will be.
Oh, yeah.
There's another one on this album. Each day just goes so fast. I turn out just dragging behind the beat. Another one on this album. My head is filled with things to say on I Want to Tell You. Or if I needed someone to love. Or only another song. If you're listening to this song, you may think the chords are going wrong. Or, little darling, it's been a long, cold, lonely winter. Or, all things must pass. Or, on it, it's all too much. When I look into your eyes, the love is there for me. Or, think for yourself. And you've got time to rectify. And so on and so on.
That is a very good theory that holds a lot of water. I think I'd never thought about it before, but yeah, he likes singing on the offbeat. He likes singing on the...
Well, he's playing, I'm guessing he's playing a guitar. That is where your voice goes, isn't it, I suppose?
Yeah.
When you're strumming.
Yeah, I never thought about that. Yes, Dan, you're right. You're absolutely right.
Then we have I'm Only Sleeping, again from Anthology 2. First, we've got a little rehearsal fragment with the vibraphone.
Love the vibraphone. Vibraphone's great. It sounds gorgeous. And did they use a vibraphone on anything ever again? I don't believe so.
Yeah.
Come in, vibraphone, one crack, one Beatles song, off you go again. It's like they didn't decide to seize upon the vibraphone like they did the sitar. It was just a one shot, one vibraphone shot. It's lovely. It's hearing them sketch this out, and you hear across all the different versions, you don't really know what the song's going to be. Because it starts off as being, I guess, slightly folky, but not really like Dylan folk.
Yeah.
It's not a rock song. It's not really a trippy song. It's not trying to evoke, like, psychedelic worlds or the unreal. It's the very opposite. It's actually... I would assume the idea of like, oh, sort of getting stoned, getting high is like, oh, you know, your perceptions are altered, and the world comes to you in different ways, and you formulate new and strange, unusual thinking. Also, you just get quite tired.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, it's the realism of getting stoned. Just a bit tired. Just a bit knackered. So it's, yeah. Like, it's hyper-realism. I know, is it? I don't know. That's probably completely the wrong phrase.
Yeah, I mean, what I love about this, that this little fragment was discovered on the end of a tape, which I think they'd done a take of Eleanor Rigby on. And apparently it's one of those tapes that you used to record and reuse and record over. So that's all we've got of this one.
Oh, that gives me
just... a lovely little thing.
Does that make your heart, like, ache a little bit and you're like, all the things that got reused? It's like, oh...
Yeah, I know.
Oh, dear. There's a lovely quote from Maureen Cleave in the Revolver book talking about this, which refers to John as being able to sleep almost indefinitely.
Yeah.
Which is brilliant, that like that ability to do absolutely nothing all day, or that work ethic that was kind of part of their whole ethos from the moment they started playing together. Very contradictory chap. As if that hadn't been noted before. You know what? I think John Lennon is slightly contradictory. You think so? Oh, well done, Matt. Shining a light. Fantastic analysis there.
We've also got take two. We've got take one on Anthology. So the nice thing about this, you can hear the song's development. So we've got Paul's bass on this. It breaks down when John messes up the keeping an eye. And I love when George Martin tells John that he's not picking up much of his guitar. So John says, I'll just have to vamp it up a bit. Now he tells him. And this is my favourite thing on the whole thing.
Really? Okay.
This line is pure John when he says, right at the end, he's sort of given up and he's just going, when I wake up in the morning, lift my whoo, I'm still, It's so sweet.
Yeah, there's the version that just rollocks along. It's Take Five, isn't it? Yeah, it doesn't sound sleepy at all.
We're going to slow that down. That was the plan.
Okay, all right. Okay, I just thought it was them trying to play it fast, see what it sounded like.
And then you've got the Mono Mix RM1, which they put on the Yesterday and Today album.
Processes that they were going through for every single song were completely different. It's not like they had any methodology that got repeated from song to song. The path from this demo to the final version is completely different to the path of every other song. It's not, there was no set method for any track, which is why they're all so hugely different.
Now, in fact, do you use a rat on his, just to
produce it. You'd like it dry.
Do you want him to use the chorus without rat at all? Do you
want
to hear it?
I can't hear you. What?
Eleanor Rigby, Take Two, and also a bit of speech before Take Two.
Oh, I mean, good Lord. This is definitely one of the highlights of the entire thing. The arrangement is clearly brilliant, so to be able to hear it being kind of formulated and run through, and hearing George ask Paul what he thinks of a seemingly imperceivable alteration in a tiny bit of the arrangements. Oh, we could do it a bit like this. I can barely tell any difference between the versions, but how they're sort of drilling down and really focusing on every single nuance. And Paul's there, like, you know, in it. George Martin is speaking to him, although it's George arrangements. Paul is as involved in the final sound of that arrangement. It's a dual kind of conversation that they're having. And it's lovely to hear on this, like, all the string players sort of chipping in and being good. Yeah. They sound really happy, don't they? They sound like they're having a nice day, like, yeah. Which goes against the whole, like, oh, every time we got classical players in, like, they were all a bit like, they looked down their nose at us, so we made them put silly hats on. These guys, this string section, are having a good day.
Yeah.
These guys, whether they've, you know, whether there was an atmosphere of gentle smokiness in the room, I don't know, but they're having a good day.
Oh, and then that could have calmed them down a bit. Yeah.
Maybe that was it. But it is, you can hear that mix of aggression and sweetness in this arrangement, which is just, and hearing it isolated like that, it's just incredible. Such an incredible moment. I mean, in terms of just a song anyway, this idea of social surrealism rather than social realism. Oh, that was good. I must remember to say that again in the future. It's okay, you had like Sound of Silence or Paint It Black or whatever that was sort of dealing in that slightly thematic concepts that still were tied to what was going on in domestic situations or kind of people's lives generally, this sort of stepping through the looking glass thing. But nobody does it quite so poetically as this song does it. And this is the same album that's got Yellow Submarine on it. Like, what the hell? It's incredible.
The thing I love about this is the very end, the very final note. If you listen, it goes on longer than the one on the record. And I love the fact that George Martin is the same as something. Oh, no, maybe we'll change that. Because it's got a very quick ending. Dun, 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 dun. Dun, dun. This one, it just goes on a bit.
Yeah.
And yeah, George, no, we'll cut that back a bit.
Yeah. Just that inherent understanding of that's not right. This is the way it should be. Dudes.
Next, we've got Ringo and Paul on a song originally called Why Let It Die for No One.
I hadn't even thought that the drums on this song were ever really like a characteristic of it. I'd kind of assumed that it wasn't really an element of the song, but it is, obviously, in the end version. This is very, very different. I just love that little, very relaxed chat. It's quite open. Paul's not like bossing Ringo about or telling him what to do. It's all just kind of like, look, just see what feels right. See what happens, you know, like, just feel it out. Recording a, once again, how old was he? 24? How could he be writing a song like that at 24? Good God. But yeah, it's a really lovely, tender little take on it, this version. It's very sweet.
In the book, you can see the original lyrics So it's, why let it die? I'd like to know. Try to save it. So, yeah, probably best to change those, I think.
Yeah.
And composed on a skiing holiday with Jane Asher. So I'm guessing it wasn't a very happy one. judging by the lyrics.
I'd love to go on a skiing holiday with Jane Asher, then or now. That would be great. What a lovely way to spend your time.
In the place where I was born, no one cared, no one cared. And the name when I was born, no one cared, no one cared. And the town where I was born, no one cared, no one cared.
Then we have a songwriting work tape, part one, Yellow Submarine.
Oh my giddy aunt. This was played on the playback that we went to at Abbey Road, and people, there was a sort of genuine inhalation of, what? Is this where it started? This version is just John strumming single acoustic guitar, and the kind of kernel of the song is there, but the lyrics that he's singing are, in the place where I was born, no one cared, no one cared. In the town where I was born, no one cared, no one cared. Which shifts the entire, for me personally, shifts the entire song into a completely different place. Obviously, it's incredible. I think there's quite a few versions on this, isn't there? Maybe there's five different versions. What's really great about this, here we go, is like if you watch Get Back, if you watch it, there's that obviously moment where you kind of see the creation of Get Back. That's the kind of origin story of that song. You see Paul plucking it out of thin air. But this progression, even though it's a song that's seen as being kind of frivolous, this is a really fascinating arc between an initial sketch and a finished song that everybody knows and everybody's kids love to sing along to. And it's just this wonderful sort of cartoon track. First of all, at the core of this colourful song that you love is, no one cared. Lennon's singing like, where I came from, nobody cared about me. Where I was born, nobody cared about me. Which is a fucking harrowing thing to have as the start of the song. And then I read a lot into it. Obviously, it's kind of a Paul and John song, isn't it? And I thought, well, his dad was a sailor, the man who went to sea. And it's like, then all of a sudden, I started to interpret it as like, this is the person that wasn't around. So this is the child inventing stories of his, these are his father's adventures that he's having when he's not there, and they're fantastical. You see where I'm going with this?
Yeah.
If you ignore everything I've said up to the point of this podcast, and feel free to do so, maybe this is the only smart thing I'm saying, or the only conceptual idea that I've got that makes any sense, rather than just going, Ringo's great. Like, all of a sudden, you've got a young boy inventing magical, incredible, fantastical stories about his dad, who's never there to tell him those stories. So it's a dream. Yes, in the psychedelic terms, but it's a wish. It's a wish of, like, you know, his dad was a sailor and a merchant sort of seaman, and he's hoping that there's something wonderful happening to this person that I guess he loves but doesn't know, who abandoned him. So it's a way of coping with that. That's what I got, which is like, it's a very different world from what it ends up as. And it shows John's trust in Paul, that he's like, okay, we can go this way with it.
We all live in a yellow submarine. Look out, yellow submarine. Get down, yellow submarine.
It might not have gone there. It could have been a completely different song. It could have been a song about, more obviously in tone with that kind of original demo. And you can see them not scared of the fun in it. That's, once again, that's a pretty ego-free thing to do. It's like, oh, this is, when I was born, nobody cared. Nobody cared about me. The place I came from, no one cared, is now turned into, we all live in a yellow submarine, which I think was Paul's, the image was his, wasn't it? The fantasticalness of it isn't in a kind of, I am the walrus. Here's lots of strange, silly imagery. It's a children's story, It was a children's story that's come from a child who felt really alone. And in the book, it says at one point, Mal Evans put a massive bass drum on his chest and marched around the studio hitting it. And you're like, there we go.
We all live in a yellow submarine. Yellow submarine. Yellow submarine. We all live in a yellow submarine. Yellow submarine.
Dong, 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 dong. Mal, put on that massive bass drum and stomp around. All right, lads. Dom, dom, dom.
Every
dom,
home dom. Should have a Mal.
Every,
you're right.
Yeah, a Mal. Every home, a Mal. Mal strapped, this is just a note from the booklet. Mal strapped this huge bass drum to his chest and we all followed him doing the conga. Brilliant.
Yeah.
There's a version that's got like a little Ringo, like mini poem at the start. How would you describe it?
That's the one, it was on the Real Love single.
Yeah.
It's, we were marched all three the day to see them gathered there from Lander Groats to John O'Green. With Stepney do we tread to see us yellow submarine. We love it.
All nursery rhymes, all old nursery rhymes have got like either a hidden meaning or like a strangeness to them. You know, Ring a Ring of Roses or London Bridge is Falling Down. They're not always, although they're childlike, the place they came from is often a lot more complicated than that. This has completely blown my relationship with Yellow Submarine apart. It really has. In a way that I loved it anyway, but I love it even more. And there's a brilliant, I think one of the versions really goes to town on the sound effects that they used. So you really get to hear, remember that, oh, if they wanted the sound of like a submarine, it wasn't a sample library with submarine samples 1 to 20 on it. They had to go and get an old tin bath and chuck some chains around and splash water. And they physically did all those things, which is just an undertaking. So, which also turns it into like a real, it's a world creation, isn't it? You know, the ambition and not just going, oh, we don't need to find an old horn and a brass section and all this. Yes, okay, we will. We are completely committed to this song as much as we are Tomorrow Never Knows. This is, the two masterpieces, not two masterpieces, they're all masterpieces. Yeah, the two kind of revelatory things in this.
It's like a little story as well, you know, the rehearsal of Yellow Submarine, John's version, through to the end. It's just like if you're feeling sad or lonely, just play the Beatles and everything is fun.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, my daughter loves this song still. But how do you go from where I was born, no one cared, to this animated cartoon with blue meanies? That's quite a journey, isn't it?
What do you call it? What's it called? Granny Smith, Bart Higgins Zoo.
Tell you. That's a nice song. Tell you.
You've never had a title, sir. For anything's ever gone wrong.
Lax and Superb.
Here it comes. Again.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Then we've got Speech and Take Four of I Want to Tell You, or Granny Smith Part Friggin' Two, as John said.
Another like super killer riff, isn't it? Like just great, great guitar playing. That thing about there's not a lot going on sometimes. I've got such familiarity with so many of these songs. I don't remember them as performances. I remember them as whole pieces of sound. So then when you hear some of these demos, you can hear the separate. Oh, okay, right, that's just not much happening. There's only four instruments or three instruments. And what's lovely about these box sets is that you do start to see, you hear the component parts that make the one thing, is the one thing that you know and you're sort of familiar with. Giles Martin mentioned this. It's like when he was doing this talk, it's like that his dad always used to say, oh, if you're going to double track something, you've got to have a really good reason for it. Like, so the one thing you do, there's one guitar, that one guitar has to do the job properly. Can't just thicken it out, but like, which is a really common thing to do, you know, double the guitars, you know, double track it, because then it will just sound bigger. No, unless it's really necessary, just have the one thing doing the job properly. You don't need two of them, just one to do it properly. And you can really hear that on this version, I think.
It's nice to know that Peering Round the Door was, at some point, was Neil Innes. He's told the story a few times about when he went to Abbey Road and they were recording this. So it's nice to know that his presence is somewhere around. Apparently years later, he went around George's house and told him the story of, you know, that he'd heard this and then George picked up the guitar and remembered the song after all those years. And, yeah, they sang it together. So it should be nice to have heard.
Crikey, yeah. Even when they're way out, even when the ship is sailing into unknown waters, they're still sometimes just like playing as a band and just doing that thing where they just get the guitars and the drums and the bass and just smash it out. And that joy, you can feel that joy in this song. It doesn't always have to be Tomorrow Never Knows. Sometimes they just still like being a band. You can feel the joy in that.
1, 2, 3.
To lead a better life, I need my love to be here. Here, making each day of the year, changing my life with a wave.
We've got take 6 of Here, There and Everywhere.
Yeah, and that, like a really beautifully flawed but incredible vocal from Paul. It's such an interesting song, this. It's one that I used to dismiss a little bit. Not dismiss, but like it wasn't a favourite, but it's such a perfect, elegant little thing. What works about the song, you can hear in the vocal on this verse, it's sung so sincerely. Like, this song, in the hands of almost any other singer, would have elements of, I don't know, cheese or cider. It's such a pure performance. You're kind of transported by it. You forget that the lyrics are very simple. It always seems strange to call them simple lyrics because they're so good. But it's very direct. It's not saying other than exactly what it's saying, and that sentiment is beautiful. But it's not soppy, and it's not corny, and it's not trite, because the way that he sings is so straight. It's a complete, this is how I feel, this is what I'm going to sing to you. There's no schmaltz, and you can hear it on this vocal, that take, because it's not perfect, but it's just absolutely heartbreakingly beautiful. And it's done in a big white room somewhere in northwest London, and he just walked up to the mic and delivered that, having had a nice time with Jane, I would imagine, had a nice skiing trip with her, hopefully. And yeah, it's not, back to my thing again about this being seen as being, oh, this is the first great psychedelic record. This is not a psychedelic song in any, this is not the 13th Floor Elevators in any shape or form. But the purity of it has a sort of shimmering beauty that is psychedelic, if this makes sense. There is like the clarity and the clearness of this song and the emotion behind it makes it feel almost surreal. It's such a perfect, flawless declaration of love and description of two people absolutely in the very, very moment of love and all the hope and the trust and joy in that it does feel almost hallucinogenic in a way because it's so beautiful. So that's what makes this a psychedelic but not psychedelic record. Did any of that make sense?
Perfectly.
Thank you. Pretty remarkable song though, isn't it? It's lovely to hear him sing it that unguarded and that like one of the first few times he ever sung it.
Hello? Hello? Okay.
So we end with a demo and take 15, which is a backing track rehearsal of She Said, She Said.
Making me feel like my trousers are torn. even that demo, I presume nobody was even listening to that, but he's just doing it to amuse himself, isn't he?
Yeah.
And he's just entertaining himself by being daft, fart-assing around in the studio.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, once again, she's making me feel like I've never been born. Wow. Actually, yeah, the line we used just to get the scanning right was trousers are torn. Yeah. Yeah, it's so amazing to feel that you're part of that process when you listen to these things, when you can chart where they're going to go. I love the fact they're doing these box sets. I just think it does open doors onto these things in a way that we never thought we were going to get. That when I had like Revolver on cassette, when I was 16 or something, I never thought there'd be, we'd get access to this stuff and it would be so beautifully presented and so gorgeously, like, laid out for us. It shows real love. Love both ways, though, isn't it? You know, there was no way they were going to just knock this out. They're treating him all properly.
Come on. Last track.
Crazy if we did one like that.
Keep going.
What I love about this particular, or the studio version, is that they were right up against it. This was recorded on the 21st of June, and they had concerts booked in West Germany for 3 days later.
Jeez.
So they had to get this song done, whatever, because it was the last track. And so you can hear, you know, John's, come on, last track.
Yeah.
And there's also, it's well documented, Paul walks out during this session. But as you can hear him on here. He is on here. But this is the backing. So we now know that he would have walked out during the vocal session, because it's only John and George singing.
Yeah, I don't know.
So that's cleared it up.
I don't hold a lot of stead in that. I'll do a bit of late name dropping. I normally get a few in early, don't I? I did an interview with Glyn Johns, and I was like, so you know, the walking out and the people leaving. And he's like, bands do that all the time. I might have mentioned this before. Like, I've been in bands, weirdly not quite as good as the Beatles. And like, having had someone going off in a huff, or just someone being bored, or someone going, I just can't be arsed today. Or like, I've really got to go and call me mum. Or like, I hate you. I can't spend another minute in your presence. That happens all the time. Even in a harmonious band, sometimes, you know, you don't want to be in that room. So I don't hold a huge amount of weight. Get Back, I guess, was a little bit different, but a lot of the time, walking out isn't walking out, you know, someone flounces off. It's like, oh, they'll be fine.
Like popping out.
Yeah. It's like, you know, sometimes it's just, oh, they just weren't there. Something else was on, you know. Yeah.
So
pretty great.
This beautiful box set, and in particular these outtakes, what did you think? What do they mean to you?
Well, Yellow Submarine, as I say, that kind of completely blew my mind. How has it made me feel? It's really because I was going to say, it makes me feel I understand the record a bit more, and I don't. The record is still the record. The record, it hasn't altered, with the exception of Yellow Submarine, how I feel about the album. I've just really enjoyed seeing those steps, seeing those processes take place, seeing, as we talked about before, how fearless and fun they were, what great players they were, how they had that ability to take ideas in such different directions, or sometimes just go, actually, this is, you know, like here, there and everywhere. We know what this is. We know what this is straight away. We instinctively know what this is. Or Tomorrow Never Knows. Yeah, we're just going to sit on one chord for 6 weeks and see what happens. To be, what is it? There's some quote about the one of the greatest abilities you have is to hold two differing ideas in your head at the same time. I can't remember what the quote was about, but it's right. There was no single way that they created this record. There was no methodology. Sometimes it's pretty live. Sometimes it's multi-layered in separate bits. It was really lovely to see how, which you understand that about this record, to see how absolutely true that was, how it was just purely like, after, as you say, at the top of the show, they had that big break and came back thinking, we're just going to do anything, not intentionally differently, but we're just going to let the songs and our instincts take us wherever they will, for any reason. That could be a really harrowing lyric turned into a kid's song. That could be a drone turned into the sort of ultimate psychedelic statement of, not surrealism, statement of experimentation, I don't know. It's like, we'll just see where these songs go, and we are the conduits for that. And we'll have a laugh while we're doing it. As has been spoken about countless times, but it always bears repeating, Love Me Do was 1962. Revolver was 1966. I don't even know what you can say about that. you know, I don't even know how they were. Yeah, they were propelled. They were spacemen, weren't they? They were taking risks and expanding as people and musicians and artists at such a phenomenal rate, such an incredible rate. It is to this day staggering. And this is, I don't know if this is Liftoff. Every record, every album is important in its own way. And they're all incredibly important, all of them. But this is, yeah, this is Everything Changes. Mind you, every single record is Everything Changes, isn't it? But this is Everything's Changed.
Matt Everett, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, man. It's always lovely to speak to you. Hey! Hey! Hey!